This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program for the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Walter Koenig, Chekhov from Star Trek, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Risk is our business.
It's like nothing we've dealt with before.
By golly, Jim, I'm beginning to think I can cure a rainy day.
I can't change the laws of physics.
Now in standard orbit, sir.
Welcome, everyone, to Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated podcast that covers the original and new cast of Captain Kirk and the Enterprise. I am Ken Tripp.
And I am Zach Moore. And in the infamous Star Trek Deep Space Nine episode, Trials and Tribulations, the Department of Temporal Investigations famously states that Captain Kirk had 17 separate temporal violations on record, the biggest file on record. And we thought, you know what, Kirk has, you know, he's gone from there to here across the space-time continuum, and you know, we thought it'd be fun to sit down and kind of go through a list of all the times that Captain Kirk and crew travel through time, at least in canon. And we had a big canon conversation last time on Standard Orbit. In canon, I don't think we're going to come up with 17, and nor do I think that line in Deep Space Nine was supposed to be like, okay, guys, we counted up all the episodes in 17. They just were making a point that, look, this guy, it's absurd. Absurd amount of time travel. So I don't think we'll get quite up to the number, but we're going to get pretty close.
Yeah, I think so. I one, that episode is just brilliant on all counts. And those two characters were phenomenal. And I love that line, 17, and just them shaking their heads so disappointed in it. But yeah, I don't know if they'll be 17 or not. But you know, it's funny, Zach, when you put this idea out there, we'll talk about this and that, and I don't know why, but my first reaction to time travel is, oh no, don't do it. Don't do it. And I don't know if a lot of people feel that way. The good news is that whenever Star Trek does it, normally they execute it really well. It's amazing to me. But I remember after Star Trek III and being at a convention and they announced Star Trek IV, we're going, yay! And they said, yeah, they had a little preview thing going, like a videotaped interview with Shatner and Nimoy. And it's, yeah, we're going to do time travel. And I just remember my heart sinking, going, oh, no. No, don't do time travel. Just keep going, right? I mean, it was one of that was my mindset. And then of course, the movie absolutely rocks it out. It was brilliant, funny, hilarious. Loved it. Same with First Contact. I was like, "No, don't go back in time." But then it works. And I think they seem to have a magic formula with Star Trek. At least in my opinion, they seem to be able to pull it off quite well.
Yeah, they could probably rename the show Time Trek because of how often they travel, you know, back and forth through time. I mean, if you look at all of the generally considered best episodes of a lot of the shows, okay, original series, City on the Edge of Forever, usually people's number one, time travel, right? Next Generation, Yesterday's Enterprise is right up there. You know, that's actually my favorite episode of Next Gen is Yesterday's Enterprise, time travel, right?
Really?
There. You look at other favorites, though, like All Good Things, time travel, right? So Time Zero, not so much, but that's a whole other conversation.
But that's an excellent point, Zach, and that reiterates what my gut instinct versus reality. They do not come together
even
at all.
Deep Space Nine, right? With Trials and Tribulations, mm-hmm. Right up there, right? Time travel, obviously, into another episode, which is brilliant. And like that's what's so brilliant about that episode. It was like the Back to the Future 2 in Star Trek, going inside a previous adventure. That was so clever and so fun. The Visitor, also up there on people's list on Deep Space Nine. That's time travel. You know, Jake Sisko, Ben Sisko. You go through Voyager, all of their, you know, best episodes, probably, you know, time travel. You get Timeless, Year of Hell, episodes like that. And then even Enterprise, right? In a Mirror Darkly, it's usually considered one of the best. And the whole temporal Cold War was a major arc in that show. So Time Trek it is indeed. I do wonder if they're going to dabble in time travel and Discovery. I think they're probably going to stay away from it just because if they're telling a 13-episode arc, like some random time travel adventure probably wouldn't fit in my opinion. But hey, look, you look at the Genesis trilogy of Star Trek 2, 3, and 4. They throw some time travel in there at the end. So you never know what you're going to come across out there. But there is a lot of time travel in Trek. And, you know, Captain Kirk was responsible for a lot of it.
Yeah, he was bad. he was very bad. He did bad things. He didn't mean to do it. Actually, he was correcting a lot of wrongs, which is also, I guess, bad, depending on your point of view. But yeah, I hear what you're saying. I guess you clarify a lot with that statement when you just look at how much time travel there actually is. And, you know, the rumored reboot Star Trek IV potentially could be, as they're talking about bringing George Kirk back into the fold. And again, when I first heard that, I went, oh, no, don't do that. And I'm hoping that it's like a holograph message or something along those lines, or lost tapes. But we'll see if they can pull it off.
But today we're going to take the time to talk about time. Let's see how much time we have. So then the naked time. Time in the title. Brilliant. I didn't even realize this until just now as we're recording. This is the first instance of time travel in Star Trek, and the word time is in the title. Brilliant. So time travel and naked time, it's accidental. It's kind of an afterthought, frankly, in the episode, and kind of a weird thing to throw in at the end as well. Because they go through, you know, the crew gets the disease, they're spiraling toward a planet, they do the cold start of the engines, it throws them back 3 days in time. And it's like, oh, well, great. On set course for the next mission. Like, I think there's a lot more to be delved into than that. They seem rather nonchalant about it. After just like from their, I guess, point of view, this is the first time any of them have time traveled before. And they're like, oh, all right, well, what's our next mission, Mr. Sulu? Set a course, you know, warp factor one, right?
Well, when they say they're going to change the laws of physics, they ain't kidding around. That's all I can tell. So, I guess, you know, if you're going to be nonchalant about changing the laws of physics in the first place, it was very clever, by the way, and I thought it was kind of neat how that occurred. They really don't explain it, No. And that's okay. But you're right, they were kind of like, yeah, okay, we get three days to live over again. Okay. Like,
well, so do they go to the planet, you know, Psi 2000 and like try to stop all that from happening, or would they run into themselves, right? It's very, very complicated. And you know, some of the original plans for this episode were to lead into Tomorrow Is Yesterday, which is the next time travel episode, but for whatever reason they shuffled that around, so the time travel element became kind of just this plot thread left over from an earlier draft. That would have been ambitious to have a two-part episode that early in the series run. I know we talk a lot about how TOS is very episodic and there's not a lot of continuity between episodes. And, well, that certainly would have been continuity to have, you know, one episode you go back in time, the second episode is you figuring that out and getting back. I mean, that would have been the first batch episodes. That would have been pretty neat for 60s TV.
It would have been, but they also would have been, I guess, back-to-back accidents, right?
Well, this would have been the accident. You know what I'm saying? They would not have fallen into a black star, as they say in Tomorrow Is Yesterday.
I gotcha. Okay. I thought that, you know, they moved. Yeah, okay. I'm with you.
Well, and you know, and I cut them a lot of slack here, as we do with a lot of TOS, because they were forging new ground as far as... Is that the forging new ground? Is that the term?
You're asking me? Jeez.
Forging.
You know, I consider myself a very educated guy, but I butcher words.
You break new ground, you forge a new path, right? I got it. You drive on the parkway, you park in the driveway. I got it. So they were breaking new ground, they were forging new paths here with this sci-fi. I mean, there wasn't, like today, time travel is everywhere, movies, TV shows, books, magazines, whatever. And yes, there were cool sci-fi concepts back then, but not in the mainstream. So Star Trek was breaking new ground, as I said, with this. So there weren't like all these rules and people weren't thinking, oh, but wait, you know, this is a pre Back to the Future world. I feel like Back to the Future is really what kind of got people like understanding time travel on the most like generic, like layman's terms level. So they weren't thinking, oh, wait, but if Marty goes back to the future and Back to the Future 2, there'll be two of them and all this. So they weren't thinking about, oh, no, if the Enterprise goes back in time, there's going to be two of them. They're going to have to interact somehow. Does that change the future? Do they become like some time remnant or whatever? See, they were thinking about that. They just wanted to cool into the story, and there it was. So they go on their very way. We see the counter go backwards, which I'm very happy. It's one of my favorite changes from Star Trek Remastered, is they changed the analog, you know, a counter, something that you find that it's obsolete.
Come on,
today.
Zach, retro's cool. Maybe it was cool in the 23rd
that
century.
That stuff is obsolete today. Okay. And it wasn't even like, it was like minutes and seconds. And so I'm so glad the Okudas went above and beyond and changed that counter to, first of all, it's digital, and then they have the star date as well. So thank you guys. Applause. One of my favorite changes.
There you go. So does that mean you liked or didn't like the clock in Star Trek VI? See what I did there?
The LED digital clock. Well, I'll tell you this. It led to a lot of continuity errors. If you watch that movie with a keen eye, that clock is all over the place. Because, you know, they do takes, and they didn't think about the behind-the-scenes. Well, they didn't think about people like us freeze-framing every, like, oh, wait, episode 15. I have to do that voice in every episode now, Ken. It's part of my content.
Well, you do it well.
17, 14, 17, 16.
So. Because I am a geek and a nerd and all those things, I did pay close attention to it. They got it right more than they got it wrong, by the way.
All it takes is one.
Yeah, no, I know. But all I was thinking of during that whole time, here we go, red alert, tangent coming, that they took a big risk in doing that. And for those reasons, you know, it's a bear to reset clocks and make sure everything's aligned or whatever. And I thought they did a pretty good job at it. But I thought it was very, you know, with all the modern look of that bridge and that set, I said, well, that clock looks very today. So it was just kind of interesting.
Well, if they did it today, they just put a little green box up there, like a green screen. They digitally put in the time, like after they edited the movie, and it would be a lot simpler. So, you know, they knew the risks. But that's why
they knew the risk.
We're aboard this ship. Anyway, moving on to Tomorrow is Yesterday. It's our next time travel event in Star Trek history. This was an interesting episode. One of the most generic titles, I think. Mm-hmm. Tomorrow is Yesterday, Return to Tomorrow, you know, All Our Yesterdays. You can get all these mixed up. We've talked about titles before. But look, if you're going to have a story about time travel, I think Tomorrow is Yesterday, pretty good title for it, right?
I thought it was very clever and very well done. And it was a fun episode, too. I liked it a lot. I liked the way it opened up. You know, everything's kind of in disarray and trying to figure things out. But yeah, it is weird how they, when these things go wrong, they always seem to wind up back on Earth. But, you know, it was a very good episode.
So it's like, how far away were you from Earth? Like, this is, and it'll happen more than once. Time travel around Earth. It's like, so did you, it's curious to me, and this is another tangent here, so a very short side tangent, but like in First Contact, right? The Borg, their plan is to go back in time, right? And assimilate Earth, assimilate the past to secure the future. So they fly all the way from the Delta Quadrant to Earth in their Borg cube. Then they open the temporal portal and go through, having almost been destroyed by the Starfleet fleet because Picard has intimate knowledge of the Borg and how they operate. Should they not have just opened that temporal vortex, that temporal wake that the Enterprise gets caught into? Should they not open that over the Delta Quadrant and just flown over there, you know, 100% in the 21st century, encounter no resistance, no pun intended, gotten the job done that way. Now, I love First Contact, but I think that's kind of a plot hole, if you ask me. So,
well, I think that's why time travel in general can create a huge plot hole all the time. Mm-hmm. One, I just took
all
it
the time.
That it was a, thank you. I just took that piece of First Contact as being a desperation move. Okay. They were coming there to invade, to assimilate, and all that other stuff.
Well
and,
said, Ken. There we go. You know, see, this is what we fans do. We justify all the mistakes.
That's right. So that's how I see it. But that does not take away from your larger argument. If it's that easy to do, then you could do it anywhere. And, you know, considering how many interactions the Voyager had with the Borg and whatnot, I mean, you could change time at any place. And I mean, in Voyager, they had a temporal starship.
The Relativity, yeah.
The Relativity. And it's just this whole thing has gotten out of control. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, when I first hear about it, it's like, I don't like it because it's too easy to change things. And then it's too difficult to explain why it doesn't happen all the time.
Mm-hmm. All the time?
That's all. All the time.
Anyway, all that being said.
Right, that was a nice Kirk movement you did there. Now, nobody can see that, but with the hands flaring and everything, it was like, that is just so Shatner. Well done, Zach.
You know, the beam captain, Christopher Ahn, they were like, oh, well, we can't send him back because he's seen us. It's like he knows our secret identity. You
know? Right, right.
He knows too much. But then they're like, oh, wait, no, his son becomes very important and leads the first mission to Saturn. So we have to send him back. Like, oh, what are we going to do? But yeah, when they you know, beam down to the Air Force base and they're all sneaking around and Kirk gets caught, you know, it's kind of played for laughs. He's like, I'm going to lock you up for 200 years. And Kirk's like, yeah, that's just about right. So that's played for laughs there. And
ha, we didn't bring that up in our continuity discussion, did we?
You know, I think we might have talked about it beforehand. There are a lot of things that we talked about. Yeah, we should talk about this, we should talk about that, we should talk about this.
Yeah. But that is that definitely gets you to the 23rd century mm-hmm. during the first season.
Yeah, it's consistent with Khan being 200 years ago, even though it's really 300 years ago. So they didn't know, guys. It's all good. You know, Kirk, he's making a joke. It's fine, you know. They didn't do so much of the fish out of water stuff. It was more Captain Christopher being the fish out of water there on the Enterprise and looking at it from that angle. So they do mention the United Earth Space Probe Agency. We did mention that in our continuity show. So
we did. Mm-hmm. Yep. So yeah, I thought it was cleverly done. I like how they made everything right the way they did it. I thought, you know, using transporter technology.
Because that makes no sense. That makes no sense to me. Beaming someone into their past self, that makes no sense.
I guess. I just looked at it. That's when they would converge, and that's why it had to be so spot on, you know, when the two come together. So
sure.
I don't know. I thought it was clever. I wouldn't know how else to fix it.
Well, they didn't. Yeah, neither did they. So they just the deus ex machina. They just but use the transporter. That'll fix the problem. So even back then, they were using that. So people give the Berman era shows a lot of flack for that. Hey, TOS has Enemy Within. They're melding, breaking people up, melding them back together through time for the transporter. We got time travel through the transporter. We got TAS. We got people getting rejuvenated a couple times on the animated series through the transporter. So it's a long Star Trek tradition that the transporter can do anything.
Sure. And that's a beautiful thing when you think the thing was invented because they couldn't afford to create shots of shuttles coming and going all the time. Exactly. And yeah, you know, hey, what the heck? I mean, it lends a lot. I like the Dr. Pulaski, right? We'll make her young again. Bing. You know, whatever it is. You're right. It is a common trope or plot device that they wound up using in the show. However, this was the first time they used it.
That's true. They
did it well.
They didn't know. I mean, they didn't know the rules yet. The audience didn't know the rules yet of time travel, like we've been talking about. Like this is new ground. So they can get away with stuff like that, and we can come some more slack because it's so early on in the series, right?
Yes, the slack is given. We must move on.
So, City on the Edge of Forever. I mean, this episode's talked about all the time. Everybody knows it's one of the greatest. Obviously, the time travel element is huge. What do you think of this Guardian of Forever being a time portal, Cam? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that we look so much at the essence of the story that the Guardian is kind of an odd thing, right? In my opinion, I like when they're approaching the planet and everything seems to be disturbed or there's temporal disturbances, things along those lines. But I thought it was okay. The episode is so damn good, and you know, it works. It's a very simple thing. You know, it's sitting there within their own Federation, it's within their own galaxy, and it's the Guardian of Forever. It's pretty extreme, but no, I think obviously the device works. Do I like the simplicity of it? I don't, but I do like the fact that it kind of hits on, you know, the chaos theory, the butterfly effect, whatever you want to call it, that a small ripple in time can have such a huge impact down the road. And that's what really made it cool, I thought. And it was okay. There was no science to it. It's kind of like the orb of time, right? Yeah. in Deep Space Nine. Oh, okay. You know, it works. We don't really know how it works, but it works. And okay, we accept it.
That's a good point, Ken, because I think this is our third iteration of time travel in the original series. All three mechanisms have been different. We had, you know, gravity and cold starting the engines kind of thing, and then naked time. We had going through what they used to call a black hole, as they say in the motion picture, a black star. Mm-hmm. They referred to it here. That was, you know, back then. I believe I don't know when exactly they figured out the difference between black holes and wormholes and stuff like that. Today, there is a theory that wormholes could create time travel, but, you know, as we see that on Voyager, Eye of the Needle, one of my favorite episodes of Voyager. It's not only is it a wormhole, it's a time hole. But And here, well, in Tomorrow's Yesterday, they say black star, black hole. People used to think, oh, yeah, you fall through a black hole, and then you show up somewhere else. Now we understand, like, a black hole is nothingness. It would rip you apart, you know? I mean, we would know. Right. We've never been in there. You know, Interstellar, I guess, shows you what the inside of a black hole looks like. But I don't know how scientifically accurate that is. It messes with the time travel thing as well.
I saw Disney's black hole. I'm still trying to figure out exactly what that was showing us.
Right.
Anyway, we move on.
But so that's science. Clearly, that's hard science, those last two episodes. And this is, you know, fantasy. It's fiction, right? I do like how The Guardian shows history in black and white. It's interesting. Like, I didn't realize that for years. Like, as a kid, I'm just watching. I'm like, yeah, well, that's The Guardian forever. You just take it. It's like the Gorn. Like, yeah, that's a Gorn. You don't think about it. Like, that's a guy in a suit, man. Like, it's like, oh, it's The Guardian forever. It's like, no, it's stock footage from, like, you know, public domain movies is what we're seeing. And it's not the most efficient display either, because they asked The Guardian, like, hey, can you, like, slow it down? Or he's like, I was created to display time in this manner. I'm like, well, this is really inefficient, man. Like, just, yeah, I mean, well, you know, they do that here, but then in the animated series, they're using, I guess they figure out, you know, more, maybe there's more access codes. Like, it's like talking to Siri, you know, you say certain things, you get certain responses. Maybe with The Guardian Forever, they say certain things, they get different responses, because then they go to Vulcan's past then, and then I know in all the novels and books, like, there's so many written about this. The Guardian.
Damn, you're a nerd, Dan.
Well, you know, like, in the book Imvadi, read Peter David, Admiral William T. Recker with Beck and Time, and he does. You know? But they figure out, you know, because it's like, this is such a cool concept, but if it's just going to be random stuff from Earth, like, there's only so much you can do. So I do like how when they expand the Guardian and other, you know, mediums and either animated series or books and stuff, they change how it can. It's not just, you know, well, you got 3 minutes, we're going to show you all of Earth's history, jump wisely. And then, so something that's always got me about this method of time travel is, so they go back there, somebody screws something up, but, like, they don't get brought back, right? I mean, McCoy didn't get brought back when he was done, so Kirk and Spock go to fix it, and then they all get brought back, and it's like, how does this work? And people always say, oh man, why did, you know, Kirk should have just brought Edith Keeler back to the future with him, and then she would have not existed and been fine. But yeah, but it's not like you can just grab somebody and, like, jump back through the Guardian. Like, I didn't think, like, they went back to a spot and jumped through. They just got pulled back when the mission was completed, when history was restored, when all is as it was, as the Guardian said. What do you think about that?
I always think that's kind of an odd thing if there isn't, you know, an exit that seems to work. And what I mean by that is it's like you can have all this complexity in the plot and a great story or whatnot, and then it all fizzles away into me sometimes when it's really simple. Now, in this episode, it wasn't a big deal at all. And I like the fact that when they pop back, the crew was like, you just left. Like, no time had really gone by. And that kind of added more reality to it, to me. I don't know why it did, but it did. You know, they didn't have to throw that line in there or whatnot, but they were like, oh, you just went in, you know, you're back. Because when McCoy jumped in, you know, it wasn't, it took some time for them to run through that cycle again, right, and all that. So, yeah, I thought that was okay. You know, I'll save some of my comments for how frustrating that can be to me, really, with Generations in particular.
Oh, but yes.
Yeah. We for this episode, didn't bother me. It is, you're right, the mission's done. Guardian seems to pull them through. I always have those things in my head. Oh, they went back to the apartment or that alleyway or whatever, right, and
that
zoom.
That boxing poster through behind him. Yeah, that is part of the Guardian guarding forever, I guess. He does a pretty bad job guarding forever. If he might just jump right through and ruin history, but
that is kind of a strange thing that you know, the Guardian has no gate.
so that's Sitting on the Edge of Forever. Now, they don't travel again in time until the final episode of season 2, Assignment Earth, which the only reason that they time travel in this episode is to set up the spin-off show that Roddenberry was working on, Assignment Earth, so that it's like a... And once you know that, once you know this is like a backdoor pilot, you're like, yeah, okay, this makes perfect sense, because the Enterprise crew, like, they don't affect the plot really in any way. They're just kind of there. You know, I mean, it's more about Gary Seven and Roberta Lincoln and what they're doing on Earth, and they're very, you know, passive characters. Like, Kirk and Spock are very passive characters in this story. Usually they're at the forefront, you know, they're driving the story forward. But
they actually hinder it.
Yeah, they, I think we talk about this in our Saving the Earth episode. Mm-hmm. Like, they have to, they almost did not save the Earth. Well, they were responsible for the problem that occurred. So, like, in a captain's log in the beginning of this episode, Kirk's like, we've traveled back in time to study how our species survived the 1960s. It's like, really? Like, if that's not breaking the prime temporal prime directive, I don't know what is.
Weren't they more specific, though? Weren't they more specific? That they were talking about an incident that occurred around that time frame, I thought.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I don't know everything, Ken. What do you think? I have some kind of trivia?
Yeah, I do, actually.
Overdoing the voice, though.
Talk about the 17 novels that took off after this. Yeah.
The Time of Eternity with Gary Seven.
But at any rate, you're right.
Well, they use the slingshot technique that they learned in Tomorrow's Yesterday to get back, you know, which shows up again, right? But that's how they travel back and forth, and that's how they're there. But it's like, talk about breaking the temporal prime directive. Like, I mean, what are you doing, man? I don't know. Like, it just, this episode, I mean, people, like, there's certain episodes, we're talking about what's canon, what's not, what's in continuity. Like, the cage and the menagerie, I feel like they have to exist separately of each other. Like, the menagerie is clearly in continuity because Kirk and Spock and all that watch the cage, right? But they they change the end of it to have, you know, the cage in the original version of the cage with, you know, with no TOS in it, the one in 1964 when they made it, the end is like Pike goes back up to the Enterprise, but the Talosians give Vina a fake Pike to like live happily ever after with, and it's like, oh, illusion. And then but the menagerie turns that on its head and it says, oh no, look, this is Captain Pike. He's beamed down to the planet. He's been restored to his youthful glory, and now he's going to live happily ever after with Vina, which is a great story, a great way to wrap up that character, right? A nice, happy ending to what a tragic character there. So those cannot exist in the same universe, right? Because those scenes are separate. So I look at that, and I'm like, okay, well, the cage doesn't really, that's just extra. And Assignment Earth, like, that's just kind of extra too. Like, this was a pilot for another show that they just showed during Star Trek. You know what I'm saying? So that's my take on it.
I agree with you. I don't particularly watch this episode if it comes on. You know, but I do understand that the reason they get involved is because, you know, Gary Seven shows up and it obviously comes from someplace else, and it gets them curious. Obviously they thought an alien being, and they were right, or whatever was interfering with Earth history. So I understand why they investigated it. I do see that as explorers. You know, you would think they'd be exploring the now, but if there was something that, for whatever reason, they had to go back and explore the 60s, it seems pretty strange to me. There's plenty to explore in their timeline.
They should have just used the Garden of Forever, Ken, because it worked so well for them last time, so.
I guess so. Okay, we're done with that one.
We don't time travel again until the end of the third season, very near the end of the third season of TOS, and it's not to Earth's past for a change, it's to Sarpedion's past.
That's very good.
So that's mixing it up, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I liked this episode. I don't know how you felt about it, but I enjoyed it. I thought it was clever. You know, they go down there and the whole population has gone to, you know, where they wanted to go. I always wondered, was there a dope who went only back like 20 years and was 40 years old or something?
It just had to keep going back.
I really enjoyed this flashback. I liked how they showed its impact on Spock. I liked it all. I thought it was a good episode. It was cleverly done. It was time travel, sort of. There was nothing accidental about it. This was, you know, a mechanism that allowed you to go with, because it was actually invented. And you would think with that kind of technology, they could just build a fleet of ships. But they used this technology to save the people of their planet. I thought that was kind of a neat element of it. You know what I mean? And the fact that they weren't prepared, and that you have to go through a preparation. You know, I'm not exactly sure what the preparation work is, but it won't allow them to adjust. In other words, if you go back in time to that era, you will regress evolutionarily, from an evolutionary point of view, back to where you were versus just being there. So interesting to me.
Yeah, I found that an interesting thing as well. It's like, you, in order to use this properly, you have to, you know, like, be prepared, whatever that entails. I mean, that obviously added some drama. Like, it added a ticking clock to Kirk, Spock, and McCoy to, like, get back to where they needed to go. Because, again, if they're in the past, I mean, who cares how long it takes them to get back to where they came from, because it's still going to be there, because they're centuries behind. So there's no ticking clock for them unless they have that, oh, no, you're going to die if you're not properly prepared.
Right.
So I like that, and that makes sense. It's a very sophisticated piece of technology, clearly. It was cool. I enjoyed this episode. People say it's like Spock sitting on the edge forever. I'm not going to go that far with it. Ming Zarabeth was a cool character, and it was nice to see him get some action. For a change. And him and McCoy really have some great scenes in this episode, huh? Just the two of them stranded
they
there
do.
On the planet.
They do. Yep. Yeah, they do. The other thing I liked about this episode is the elements that there were other people from the current timeline that were interspersed, especially on Kirk's piece of it.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah.
And they were like, yeah, okay, we'll try to help you out for this.
It's like, oh, you didn't know about that? Oh, gosh. Okay, well, we got to get you back. Like that was cool. Yeah, that was a cool piece.
Yeah, the witchcraft element of it. And then, yeah, Zarabeth and that whole plot line was pretty neat. I like seeing the regression of Spock and whatnot. But I also thought it was interesting that the fact that she was there was, you know, from a vindictive ruler, and that to me was pretty fascinating all of its own.
Well, would you like to know how they follow this up in the novels, Ken?
I think I read that one.
It was Yesterday's Son and Time for Yesterday.
Yes. He goes back. That's right. She has his son. That's mm-hmm. right. And I did read that's an old novel. Mm-hmm. That goes back to the 80s. So I did read it. I don't remember it well, but I did read it. And yeah. I do remember that that was pretty powerful. Yeah.
Yeah, good stuff. And last thing I'll say about this one is you remember the show Terra Nova?
I think so. I sometimes I confuse it with Earth 2, but I do remember
or
Terra Nova.
Space Above and Beyond and all that. No, so Earth 2 was like in the 90s, but Terra Nova was actually just a few years ago. It starred, Stephen Lang is probably the most famous actor in, and it was basically the plot of this episode, right? It's like the world is ending. We have to go back, but it's set on Earth, okay? It's like the world is ending. In order to preserve our race, the key to our future is in our past, right? I'm sure that was like the tagline for this show. But they go back in time, they live in Jurassic times, or Cretaceous times, or Triassic times, whatever the dinosaur times, right? And there's dinosaurs, and it was a very ambitious show. It was extremely expensive, and the ratings just weren't there. Because it was so ambitious and expensive, they canceled after half a season. So, like, you know, Fox pulled another Firefly. I never had watched it myself. I thought it was an interesting concept. And, you know, since it's only 13 episodes, I might go check it out sometime. But I wonder, like, if they thought of this episode. Although I do question the long-term viability of this. Would they not continue to, like, overwrite their own history if they do this, right? Or is it one of those dreaded predestination paradox things we'll get into later? I don't know. But because you can't just keep going back in time, right? I mean, you're going to run out of time at some point. Like, there's just too many people and population. Because if everyone keeps doing that, right, it's not sustainable. So,
yeah, it wouldn't be a show that I would want to watch, to be honest with you. It's it's one of those things where we go, no. So I can understand why it would die. You know, I remember watching Highlander, and I like the fact that they would flash back to ancient times, and you know, you would kind of get the now and the past, and you would understand more of the history by them showing it, right, through a storyteller method and that type of thing. And I don't mind that at all, but the constant going back and forth, that I would be like, nope, done, see you later, next episode. I'd go on to something else. I really don't like, I don't know why. Like I said, I've been proven so many times wrong in Star Trek because they do it right. For an episode here and there, I can handle it. A TV series, no freaking way. Gotcha. See you later.
Well, that closes the book on time travel in the original series, which is, you know, really not that many episodes. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, only 5 out of 79 episodes. That's a pretty good ratio, guys.
Yeah, but how many violations did he have within those episodes?
Well, that's true. You see, if you double them, like if you like count like what he did like while he was traveling in time, maybe it does add up to 17. I don't know. That's a good point.
Because in Tomorrow Is Yesterday, he winds up with none. He fixes everything.
See, I see. That's an interesting point. You say is like, oh, he's going back in time, and now he's like doing things that count as violations. I just saw it as the violation is you travel in time. So that's interesting. Okay, so yeah, I think if you really break it down, you could get 17 if you want.
Well, it's just because of the temporal investigation, 17 violations, they said. And I took that as somehow that impacted the timeline. Somehow,
time traveling without a license.
Traveling with, yeah, well, that could be the first one. That could be the first one. He didn't have permission to. He had permission for all our, for all our yesterday.
See?
I'm sorry.
These titles are confusing, aren't they?
Assignment Earth. He had permission, mm-hmm. right? They were doing research. Everything else, no, he didn't have permission. He, you know, they just didn't. They just went and did it on their own. or accidentally.
Yeah. Well, that's TOS. Moving on to TAS, there's only one instance of true time travel in the animated series, and that's yesteryear. Universally considered, I mean, I was going down the list earlier of like, what's the quote-unquote best or favorite episode of all the shows. Skip the animated series. Sorry, Aaron. There is an animated series, but yesteryear is, I think universally, everybody thinks yesteryear is the best episode of the animated series. I would agree. It's definitely the most, you know, in canon, if you want to pull that old chestnut out again, because there's so much of it that carries on, that they reference back into in later Star Trek, where so much of the rest of the animated series is forgotten. But this is a great episode. You know, it's Spock, meeting younger Spock. I know that when they're talking about Star Trek 09, and there was Leonard Greenboy was going to be in it as older Spock, they're like, oh, is he going to pose as Spock's cousin Selick again, you know, to get really inside baseball and tie into that. But no, he said, hey, look, I'm old Spock. Just, you know, I like that they were upfront about that. But this is a great episode. We revisit the Guardian of Forever. The rules are a little bit different this time. The whole crux of it's a little odd because Spock was always supposed to go back and save himself, but because he was time traveling to another planet at the time he was supposed to go back and save himself, he died, so they come back, and it's interesting side effect seeing the Andorian first officer. That's pretty good. That's the race that got no play until Enterprise, so it's cool to see him here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I enjoyed this. I watched it, I guess not that long ago, 3 or 4 months ago, and I had forgotten. I remembered the plot, but I had forgotten how detailed they were in it. You know, and Mark Leonard was, that was Sarek's voice.
Mm-hmm. That was not James Doohan. It was Mark Leonard.
Yeah, for once, right? And it was pretty cool. It's such a dated thing to watch sometimes, and it's you know, and of course the animation. Well, a lot of people love it. It is difficult, but from a storyline or whatnot, I mean, you could make that a live action version of that, and it could play very, very well. And yeah, I can understand why it's considered the best, because it was probably the most well thought out, and it actually had ties in, you know, in the animated series. You know, they go back to the Tribbles and Harry Mudd and things like, you know, every once in a while you kind of go back. So they do, they're less episodic, I guess, than even the TV show was, because they'll go back and touch on things. And I just thought there were a lot of things that they pulled out of Journey to Babel into this episode as well, and they did a nice job with it. So yeah, it was nice that way.
Mm-hmm. And you know, and the stakes are small. It wasn't like Spock has destroyed the space time continuum. It's like, no, just save yourself, right? I mean, that was nice too, because not every time travel has to be, oh no, the universe is unraveling. So
right. Yeah, it was pretty good. And you know, the whole being half human dynamic and all that stuff
which they lifted this well directly for Star Trek 09, you know, his struggles as a child, talking to Sarek, being bullied and all that good stuff. So that's the animated series. Now we're going to the movies now. The Voyage Home. It is the big time travel one for the original series movies. Love it. You know, that in concept it sounds like what? Excuse me? Like the crew of the Enterprise goes back to the 1980s to save some humpback whales. I think the whole premise of it is so perfectly illustrated in the scene between Kirk and McCoy. They're talking about the plan, and McCoy's like, let me get this straight. We're going to go back in time. We're going to go around the sun. We're just going to pick up some whales, come back, hope we can talk to this probe, and hope everything works out. And Kirk says, that's the general idea. And he's like, that's crazy.
I hope to God it tells this probe what to do.
So good, because I mean, it's self-aware. It brings you on the journey. Like, it's like, look, guys, we know this is pretty crazy, but just come with us. We're gonna have a good time. And that's what this movie is, right?
Mm-hmm. And then that's really all it is. No real villain in this at all. Just
man is the villain.
You know, man itself. Yeah, and that gets old to me too at times. But this was played accurately, and I think it did. I think this movie went a long way to helping its cause, actually. But yeah, it was light. It was fun. They used continuity in the sense that they used the slingshot effect to do it. You know, the only thing is, you know, we yell at the JJ verse for, you know, kind of the confusion with warp speed or whatnot, but the speeds that they were traveling around the sun, you know, it would be nanoseconds.
Well, they go to warp speed inside the atmosphere.
Right.
I don't know if that was a visual.
Motion picture was too dangerous to do within the solar system. So yeah, it was crazy.
Like, I don't know if that was a visual effects thing or a script thing, but yeah, you see the bird of prey, just, you know, the warp effect, like you're in San Francisco sky. It's like, oh, okay, I guess we're doing that.
Yeah, because if they were doing warp one, it would take 1 second to get to the sun.
They do some interesting stuff though with the time travel. It's very trippy, isn't it? Yeah.
Right? No offense taken.
I know. I was going to say, how could I turn that into some pun about you, Ken? But I don't know. But anyway.
That's like, okay. No worries.
The sculpted heads and the reeds mm-hmm. and the water and like the mannequin and on fire. Like that. Like what is that all about? What did that speak to you? When you're sitting in the theater in 1986 watching that, what did you think?
I don't remember what I thought. I think it was one of those things that even today I watch it and I do the Spock eyebrow raise and go, okay. The only thing that I take out of it that I enjoy is the fact that after the movie's over, you realize the lines you were hearing them speak came in the future part of the movie. So I thought that was really, really cool. You know, but I didn't get it at all. I thought it was just some kind of artsy thing that they did to add a little mystery to it and all that other stuff. And, you know, the water droplets and all that other stuff. And when they kind of come out of it, it was just damn strange, I thought.
It's kind of like the end of 2001 in a way.
Yeah, but, you know, they slingshot around, you know, they wake up in Tomorrow Is Yesterday and kind of a similar thing, right? They're down, they're trying to figure things out. Really don't see that happen in Assignment Earth, though. That could have happened. We really don't.
There we go. We always talk about fan edits and special editions. Yeah. We need to make the same sequence every time that Enterprise does the slingshot thing.
Yeah, and then when they go back, there's nothing. You know, it's just,
well, it's like, yeah, you guys have seen that.
Yeah, we're back. We're back. They could have taken the whole thing and just done the whole thing in reverse, you know.
Let's see that in an instant replay.
Yeah. So. But, I thought it was pretty cool, you know. It was different.
They'd done time travel many times in the show, as we've been discussing here. And so I guess they figured, no, let's do something different. Yeah. You know, we got a big budget now. Let's see it. So that was cool. It's a cool visualization of something like breaking the laws of nature.
Sure.
So that's what I took it as.
Yeah, yeah. So I didn't, I guess I was very neutral on it. But, you know, I think back, yeah, so it was okay. It bridged it, even though you were confused as heck. Right. It bridged it.
Now, and they're pretty fast and loose with talk about temporal violations here, that they basically give this guy the formula for transparent aluminum. Scotty's like, how do we know he didn't invent the thing?
Right.
It's like, really? Like, that's what we're going to do? Okay. You know, and they take Jillian Taylor with them, and it's like, these are serious temporal violations. You thought saving Edith Keeler from a car accident was going to screw up history. I think this stuff would screw up history a lot as well.
Oh, come on now. I mean, you're taking whales that don't exist in one century, putting them into another. God knows what they're pulling back with them. For all we know, every fish is dead in the 23rd century.
Oh man, yeah, that's a good. I never thought about that, Ken. The bacteria alone, be like the Martians in War of the Worlds, just wipe them out.
So. Yeah, who knows?
Well, thanks, Kirk. That's a major violation.
It could be.
Generations would be our last one for as far as, you know, Captain Kirk himself traveling through time. That's where we're kind of focusing in here in our conversation. And you know, he gets sucked into the Nexus, no fault of his own. We've talked about the Nexus many times. It's not really the time travel element here. The time travel element is when Picard convinces him to leave, like, come back with me to Viridian 3, and they stop Sorin, Malcolm McDowell. And yeah, so Picard just needed Kirk's help to beat up this guy, and he did, and they saved the day. It's like, man, like, that's what we needed Captain Kirk for, huh? Like, that's the one thing that Kirk could do that no one else could do, was just beat up some guy on a cliff, right? And he dies. So that's why the time travel here is disappointing. I mean, if you listen, I've probably said this before, I'm sure I have somewhere on Trek FM, but if you haven't listened to the commentary on Star Trek Generations, the DVD or Blu-ray by Brandon Bragg and Ronald D. Moore, they admit, they're like, hey, you know what, the Nexus was supposed to be this like convergence of past and present and future, and I don't think you really relayed that very well, and again, there's no rules, like they just decide to leave, so they leave and that's it, like the power of positive thinking gets them out of the Nexus, and Kirk's in the 24th century, he dies defeating Sorin, and then Picard buries under some rocks, and it's like, man, that's what we skipped ahead 80 years for, man. It's like, what a waste of time traveling Kirk to the 21st century. That was my take on it.
Oh, it was freaking useless. It was so disappointing, and I remember wanting to like it so bad, but that's it exactly, Zach. It makes absolutely no sense. Like you said, there were no rules around it. It made no sense. As soon as that stupid ribbon left Viridian 3 and off on its way, when they rode their horses out, they should have been in space and just popped like a couple of zits. It made no sense. It was just really poorly done. And you know, it's frustrating.
Well,
it's really frustrating.
It's a it's a missed opportunity, because when people time travel, you want to see them interact in the new time period. I mean, the time travel here wasn't so much about the time travel. It was like a mechanism just to get Kirk and Picard together. But if you bring Kirk to the 21st century, you want to see him, like, meet Worf, right? What's his reaction to him? You want to see him hit on Deanna, right? You want to see him do these, or Crusher, right? You want to see him do these things that you knew Kirk would do if he was, like, on the Enterprise-D. And it would be great if, like, he was on the Enterprise-D and, like, it was crashing. Like, he takes, like, the battle bridge and does something and goes down, guns blazing. And, you know, I mentioned yesterday's Enterprise is my favorite episode of Next Generation. And that's, I love the ending where Picard goes out, you know, guns blazing, like the bridge is on fire. Everyone's dead around him. And he's going down. He's like, oh, that'll be the day. He jumps over the controls. He starts firing phasers. He's like, yeah, man, that's Picard. And so Kirk should have gone out that way. You know, well, actually Kirk should have flown off into the sunset and we never knew what happened to him. Right. Cause true heroes, legends never die. But if we had to see it, that should have been the way to go. It's just a big missed opportunity, bringing him to the 21st century and doing nothing with it.
They missed it 100% in this movie with the time travel aspect. It just made zero sense, and it was really frustrating to watch, because, you know, being a fan of both, you want Picard to be successful, you want him to go out in a blaze of glory, you want him to do things right, you want the same thing for Kirk, and they just didn't give it to him. And to me, that's the crime of this movie, you know.
I mean, there's a lot of things you can nitpick, but that's the deal breaker.
It really is. It's sure. Like you killed Kirk over Roddy McDowell. Come on.
Roddy McDowell.
Malcolm McDowell, right? Malcolm McDowell. Yeah. But yeah,
Andy McDowell.
Yeah, pick a McDowell, any McDowell. But yeah, I mean, you killed him over this, you know, I mean, two guys in their early 60s battling it. It was pathetic. It was just so poorly done. If I could go back in time, it would roughly be, let's see if I get the date right, probably around late 1993 when they started scripting this thing. And all I would need is the back of my hand to start slapping people going, no, this is not what you're going to do. This is how you're going to do it. When you're just talking about the time travel element of it, it had a couple, right? It had the Nexus. It had the holodeck, you know, with being on the ship and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, that was kind of a neat play, I think. And it that's the thing, is it did have some promise, but you know, I don't know. There was just too much, you know, I'm not trying to make it a movie review, but there was too much drama, too much silliness within the drama, Data in particular, killing off Picard's family, because my favorite episode in Next Generation is Family, by far. Love that episode. And I love the tie to his nephew and all that stuff. And I
killed your favorite captain and your favorite episode of Next Gen in this one movie, one foul swoop.
That's what I mean, dude. It's like, come on. Why did you have to do that?
Well, speaking of, to tie it all back to time travel and then move on here, what they should have done, clearly, as every nerd on the internet with a YouTube channel has explained over the last 25 years, is Picard goes to the Nexus, goes back in time with Kirk. You know, you bring Kirk out, maybe it doesn't work out, you know, they try it once. So then Kirk goes back to the Enterprise B, saves the day there, doesn't get sucked in, right? You have, you know, Chekhov and Scotty, ideally Spock and Bones, but whatever. But Chekhov and Scotty, like, looking out into the chasm, and then, like, you see Kirk, like, come up behind and put his hand up, like, hey, I'm here, I'm back, I'm fine. You know, something like that. Just like that, too. But then, so you're like, oh, Kirk, he's still the legend, right? He's still, his end of his story has not been written. It's left to our imagination. And then Picard goes back to the Enterprise D and, like, you know, sends a message to Earth and, like, you know, they get to communicate with Earth from Earth. Like, Worf says, oh, just come in, Captain. Your brother says thank you for having him double-check the farm. Or, you know, something like that to imply that we use the time travel to solve the problem. Because in every other episode of Star Trek where there's time travel, there's a huge reset button. All these problems are fixed. If this was an episode of Next Generation, Picard would have used it to save his family. Or if this was an episode of the original series, Kirk would not have died, right? But they in the rare case, we always complain about the reset button. But this is a movie where they needed to use the time travel reset button.
I just think that sometimes when you go from TV to motion picture, they talk, oh, it has to be dramatic, it has to be all these things. You know what it needs to be? It needs to be entertaining. And you know, even in Star Trek III, your favorite movie of all the Star Treks, and I love it too. It's like, oh, there was a lot of drama in there. Did they need to kill David? I don't know. Did they need to destroy the Enterprise? Yeah, but I was kind of hoping they would have upgraded it. It's just one of those things. It's like, if you're going to do it so that it really feeds into the next one. And in Generations, a lot of the things that they did really didn't add any value. It just took away things that, if you, as we talked about in talking about the continuity discussion, if you really want to live in this universe to a certain degree and enjoy it, don't rip things away just for the sake of we need more drama. Well, be very careful where you put that drama, you know. And that's kind of why I think Generations fails on so many levels. Destruction of the Enterprise, destruction of Picard's family, the death of Captain Kirk. Heavy, heavy, heavy stuff, but it was done poorly. It was executed extraordinarily poorly.
All could have been fixed with proper time travel, Ken.
That's right.
So we teased this topic on the Babel Conference, and you guys, as you always do, had a great response. And I want to talk to some of you guys in particular, Matthew Bell. So thank you for your response. You were talking about how you're a predestination paradox kind of guy, because something else I brought up was, hey, what kind of time travel do you guys like? Do you like the predestination paradox rule? Do you like the, you know, malleable timeline where you can, you know, break it and fix it and break it and fix it and all that back and forth? I personally agree with you, Matthew. I'm a predestination paradox kind of guy. I think if time travel ever really happens in the real world, that's the way it's going to have to be. Because if you think about it, like, people could destroy the space continuum on a regular basis, as we see in Star Trek. I mean, and you point out, Matt, that it's like, we're just humans. We're little specks in the universe. Like, it's ridiculous to think we would have that much power to, like, unravel history as we know it. And the other reason I'm for the predestination paradox is that locks everything into, like, one universe. Episodes like Parallels on Next Generation, and I love Parallels, by the way. Earl Grey just covered it in an episode. Great episode, guys, and of yours and of Next Generation. I love that episode because it shows you, as fans, you want to see all these what ifs, right? Like, oh, what if Picard didn't survive Best of Both Worlds, or what if Riker became captain, and all that stuff. That's cool to see, but, you know, you take a step back from that, it removes all the stakes. Like, if everything happens, like, no matter what choice you make, it doesn't really matter when you made the other choice in a million other universes, you know? So that kind of, like, undercuts drama to a certain extent, and not just in fiction, but in life in general. So I am the predestination paradox kind of guy, because that means that, like, hey, look, you can't change anything. It's all locked in. If there are time travelers one day, they just would become part of history. I mean, there's a lot of Twilight Zone episodes about this. A lot of, you know, talk about time travel in Star Trek. There's a lot of time travel in the Twilight Zone, and some, you know, they're anthology, so they can have different rules in every episode. Of course, Star Trek seems to have different rules in every episode. That doesn't seem to stop them either. But I like that one the best. Where, like, when you go back in time and you become, like, part of the history, and you always were part of the history. Like, the example I always use as a perfect closed loop of time travel is Terminator, the first Terminator, the Terminator, right? So Skynet sends Arnold Schwarzenegger Terminator back in time to kill Sarah Connor before John Connor is born. So the Resistance sends back Kyle Reese to protect Sarah Connor. Kyle Reese becomes the father of John Connor. So, but he never would have been, none of this would have ever happened if it had not been put in place in the future. So people say, oh man, did John Connor have a different dad? It's like, no. This is how it happened. Like, there's a predestination paradox, because Kyle Reese and the T-800 always went back in time. Kyle Reese gave birth to John Connor. The T-800, when it was discovered by Skynet scientists, or Cyberdyne Systems, they invented the Terminators in Skynet. So they both birthed each other. And it's just this brilliant closed time loop. Now, Terminator 2, it's kind of a necessary, kind of veers off. But, you know, it's so amazing that we forgive it for breaking that time loop. The rest of them just go really out of control. But that's my perfect, like, time travel, like, example. And then you get the other kind of time travel, I guess, is, you know, the most popular one would be the Back to the Future one, where you go back in time, you fix something, and things are going to continue. The phrase they use in Back to the Future is, if things continue on their present course, that's how it's going to be. So that kind of explains how they have time to fix things and whatnot. You know, we had the visual aids of, like, the Marty's picture of his family, you know, or the matchbook for Biff in Back to the Future 2 and all that. Those are your two basic schools of time travel, right? And I think Star Trek seems to use both throughout its franchise for whatever story.
Depending on the situation.
Yeah, right? Depending on the situation, depending on the story, depending on the series, you know. But I think that's good. I mean, there are no real rules yet for time travel. So it's fun. If what is fiction for if not to explore these possibilities?
I get you. And I agree. I like that. I saw a nice comment in here about, you know, speaking. It was Carlos. That's who it was. Said it before, and I'll say it again. For both me and Captain Janeway, gives me a headache. The whole paradox discussion does. And I think it's great that they even called it out in Star Trek as well, because it was used so many times. But, you know, this was a pretty good a pretty good thread. You know, there was a lot of people getting into the game. And I like the fact that, you know, whenever you reach out to these guys, our listeners here, whether it's Matthew or Rebecca, Tim Hands, of course, is always quick, and Christopher Baca. there's some good conversations here about when they first kind of went through it and what pulled them in to these specific episodes. But
Christopher Corey gave us about a dissertation on that. So I mean, that's
pretty, yeah, he tries to get at it.
Appreciated,
yeah.
There, Chris Corey.
Yeah, if any of you are not on the Babel Conference and you're listeners to our show, I would recommend you come in, because it's easy. The admin will let you in, and then specifically look for this thread that Zach put up there. The 17 separate temporal violations. You search that, you'll find it.
Yeah, yeah, it's got the picture of the bird of prey doing the slingshot around the sun. So
yeah, and Christopher really went to town listing it all out, and I think it's a very good read. It's a very good read.
All right, well, time travel isn't the only thing we've been discussing this week on Trek FM. Here's a quick look at what else you might have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
I agree, and I think most people, if they really think about it from the business standpoint, would agree that for Star Trek to compete with other properties in 2017, to connect with an audience that's not the diehard Star Trek fans that we are, it does kind of have to look like this, because that's where the expectations are.
Right.
Standard Orbit.
Who says we've been exposed to the vast amount of fictional history or history that exists within that timeline to be able to piece it together? It's huge. We don't even have our arms around of what's going on a daily basis around this planet. So if you take the whole size of the Federation, I think it could be very easy to plug and play this timeline there, enjoy something we've never heard of, never seen, that wouldn't necessarily impact the history that we already realized through the original series.
Warp 5.
There is a lot of dialogue or an exchange between the two of them where she implies very strongly to Archer that their relationship has evolved over the years. And he asks, oh, really, how far has it evolved? And she kind of gives him a look.
The original
draft of the script, she actually gave him an answer.
The 602 Club.
I think that creates a great question we can dive into, the creator versus creation. Wayland has created David in the synthetics to help him on his quest. And his quest is this. He does not believe that human beings can be nothing but a random chance accident.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcast. If you're an Apple user, get the show on iTunes or the Apple Podcasts app. Be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Speaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well.
If you'd like to get in touch with us here at Trek FM, you can always find us on trekfm.com/contact. And look in the sidebar on the show page, or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm, and please leave us a voice message. You can also contact us through Twitter at trekfm, or on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, and of course in the Babel Conference. Type Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trekfm and click discussion on the menu bar. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron on the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find the current goals and different milestone contributions, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details on patreon.com/trekfm. Speaking of Patreon, thank you as always to our great associate producers for Standard Orbit. We have Renee Roberts, Norman Lau, Aaron Harvey, Tim Robertson, Nick Anastasio, Richard Marquez, and Corey Elrod.
Yes, thank you guys so much for your support for both Standard Orbit and Trek FM. So Ken, if people want to find you out there on the internet, where can they find you?
Hi, you can find me hanging around the Babel conference and engaging people when I have the opportunity. You can also find me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @BostonSCPO. And we like to tweet out all our new episode information as soon as we get it, as well as our colleagues. So look for me there.
As for me, you can find me on Twitter @MoronZach. That's MoreonZach. And I'm also the host of my own podcast, Always Hold On to Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of that Young Superman series from the early 2000s. And you can find us on Twitter @AlwaysMallville with one S. So thanks everyone for listening, and join us again next time here on Trek FM for another episode of Standard Orbit.